It is episode 165 of the Far Middle Podcast, the Dog Days of Summer edition. We're not far left, and it's not far right here. It's the far middle of the road where rational thought and logic prevail. Quite a unique position in today's polarized world, don't you think? I am the host, Nick Deolius, and allow me to get to the episode's dedication when it comes to the world of sports. It's to a place built for the boys of summer, baseball. And it is my favorite baseball stadium in the U.S. of A. We all know it as Dodger Stadium or Chavez Ravine. And it is a wonder and a cathedral. And its history and impact stretches well beyond the world of baseball. Opened in 1962, it was constructed in less than 3 years, get this, at a cost of $23 million then, which is about $230 million in 2023 dollars. Many fans don't realize Dodger Stadium is the oldest Major League Baseball stadium west of the Mississippi River, and it's the third oldest overall, younger only than Fenway Park in Boston. That was built in 1912. And Wrigley Field in Chicago, which was built a few years later in 1914. Chavez Ravine is the largest baseball stadium in the world by seating capacity, and it has seen a lot occur on its diamond, a lot of baseball history. Stadium hosted 13 no-hitters, two of which were perfect games. The numbers retired in that stadium include prior far middle dedication subjects of Don Drysdale, Sandy Koufax, Jackie Robinson, and Fernando Valenzuela. Six home runs have been hit completely out of Dodger Stadium. And guess what? Outfielder Willie Stargell, another far middle dedication subject of my hometown Pittsburgh Pirates, he hit two of those six home runs out of the stadium. Dodger Stadium has been deemed the most popular Major League Baseball stadium by fans, and I completely agree with that. Tommy Lasorda, the Hall of Fame legendary manager, tagged the stadium as Blue Heaven on Earth. But I'll tell you, building the Shrine, it didn't come without controversy and collateral damage that's going to be of interest to not just baseball fans, but also non-baseball fans alike. The land for Dodger Stadium had been seized from local owners and residents in the early 1950s by the city of Los Angeles, and it used eminent domain with funds from the Federal Housing Act of 1949. And the city had planned to develop public housing, but before construction could begin, the local political climate changed, and public housing projects lost support. So following a whole series of protracted negotiations, the city purchased the Chavez Ravine property back from the Federal Housing Authority at a drastically reduced price, with the stipulation that the land be used for a public purpose. And it wasn't until June 1958 when Los Angeles voters approved a Taxpayers Committee for Yes on Baseball referendum. Does that sound familiar? We see them all the time, all across the country. And then the Dodgers were able to acquire the 350-plus acres of Chavez Ravine from the city, and Los Angeles forcibly evicted residents from their homes, who were mainly Hispanic. Yeah, not everything is pretty about Dodger Stadium when you see how it got built. Bully government, eminent domain, taxpayer dollars used to subsidize the stadium, and evictions and leveling of neighborhoods. But Dodger Stadium itself, if you exclude the land acquisition subsidy, it was the first Major League Baseball stadium since the initial construction of the original Yankee Stadium to be built using 100% private financing. And it was the last one, in fact, until Oracle Park in San Francisco opened in 2000. And its impact, as I said, it goes well beyond baseball. Just about every major musical act the past 60 years have played at Dodger Stadium, including the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. The most famous concert there is probably Elton John, who in October 1975 performed two sold-out concerts, and these are widely regarded as two of his most famous shows. If you look up images of those concerts, you'll see Elton wearing sequins in a Dodgers uniform as he performed. Rock history right there. So we dedicate our episode to the magnificent Dodger Stadium, the baseball history, the cultural history, and the not-so-pretty story of how it got built. Ain't that often America in a nutshell? Dodger Stadium, both its great and troubling realities, serves as a perfect connection to the main focus of this episode, episode 165. I had the opportunity to give a speech and interact with a group of Southern California business leaders this summer. And our location was downtown LA, only 2 miles to the south of Dodger Stadium. And it was quite an engaging experience. I wanted to share the main points of my talk and conversational items that we as a group focused upon afterward. And it's funny, but when I was up on the podium toward the end of the event, my mind started to gravitate to two things. First, how many hours is it going to take me to get from downtown LA to Orange County where I was staying? And second, boy, a synopsis of the past hour or so, hour and a half, it would make for great far middle content for our constant listeners. And by the way, shout out to those constant listeners that were in attendance that day in downtown Los Angeles. Made it even more fun. So what did we discuss? Well, you can find a transcript of the speech if you're interested on nickdeolius.com, and I'd encourage you to give it a read. There's also, of course, a lot of other content on the nickdeolius.com website. But I'm going to start sort of on the back end of the event when someone came up afterward and started to talk about that mosaic as to beliefs and convictions and philosophy that I apply in life and how similar it was to them and from their perspective, very logical, but also how vilified it has become by the left, and particularly in places like California and Los Angeles. We've talked about that mosaic in the past, sort of a technical background, right? And being an engineer, but whether you're an engineer or a scientist or in the medical profession, it means you're going to be passionate about the scientific method and objectivity when setting policies, especially technical ones. And if you are going to be a fan of the scientific method, that means you're also not going to be a fan of, and you're going to be deeply troubled by, the science that we hear about all the time today. We talked about being a classic liberal and how at times the left and, frankly, the right might warrant to be also classic liberals or defenders of the individual, but maybe only when it suits them to consistently defend the individual. Is that's what it means to be a classic liberal when it comes to individual rights. The Constitution, the nation itself, was structured to protect the rights of the individual. From what? Well, from the tyranny of the majority and certainly from the state itself or the government. Yeah, you always want to leave the individual to be free to choose for themselves. And that means you got to protect them from those two tyrannies. We talked about a fiscal conservative and taking the approach that if a household or if an individual or if a business that's successful wants to be sustainable, if it never spends more cash than it or they take in, then that means that you should apply the same sort of thinking to government, right? But you see government grossly outspending what it takes in. And then you talk about sort of political affiliations these days. There was a lot of banter in the room about Democrats, Republicans, but in the end, a lot of the beliefs when you are for individual rights and you want sort of small government that's fiscally conservative, maybe that's best defined as libertarian. And that doesn't necessarily mean we're all out there voting for RFK Jr. or some other candidate that's out there, but it does mean that you recognize that there is some need for some level of government to protect property rights and to defend from outside threats and to protect individual rights. But that level of government should always be pushed towards minimal. Why? So that the individual is optimized or optimal. I saw recently that the Prime Minister of India, Mr. Modi, has a saying or a phrase that he throws out there, which sort of applies to the libertarian way of thinking. He likes to say, minimum government, maximum governance. I think that's a good summation of such desires. And being a proud capitalist and a proud capitalist within the domestic energy industry and specifically within the natural gas industry, not apologizing for it and believing in things like meritocracy and the free market. Yeah, that mosaic is outright vilified today by a lot of elites and a lot of experts and, of course, the left, and sometimes, in fact, by the right, as something that's in need of silencing and eradicating. And you see it everywhere, right? The science, as I mentioned earlier, it reigns over science. Individual rights are trampled by the official views set by the elite and expert classes. Fiscal responsibility in government, it's obliterated. We pretend the bill's never going to come due, but it will. Government itself has become a monster, light years away from minimal. And socialism, yeah, it's eating away at capitalism. You got things like zero carbon myths that are used to attack domestic energy and the industry itself. And of course, equal outcomes are destroying meritocracy. But most of the interest from the audience, and not surprisingly, was having them hear from me on my views on the energy industry, the domestic energy industry, and specifically natural gas. And that's not a surprise coming from Appalachia and talking to an audience in California, because there's sort of the reality of what we see in the domestic energy industry itself versus what a lot of Californians are being fed when it comes to energy policy myths. So there was a hunger there for learning about what's actually going on. And it was interesting because even though my world, or Appalachia, Texas, Louisiana, however you want to define the domestic energy industry, it might seem far from California, I made the point to the audience that, in fact, the domestic energy industry impacts everything going on in California. And it's an opportunity to compare and contrast what they're hearing and being fed with those energy myths versus the reality and what's actually going on in the real world. And I told them, in many ways, it's the greatest success story that's never been told. In the U.S., going from being a net annual importer of natural gas as recently as 2016, it's now the largest global producer of natural gas and a net annual exporter today. A lot of people don't realize that that seismic shift that's occurred. The Appalachian Basin is a big reason why. You've got the Marcellus and Utica shale horizons, of course, underneath, literally where I'm recording today, where I'm sitting. And together, they cumulatively represent the second largest natural gas field in the world. So what catalyzed this stunning rapid transformation in dominant position? Well, it was some of the aspects of that mosaic that I was talking about a few minutes earlier. The free market brought innovative and disruptive technology in the form of horizontal drilling and advanced completions techniques to bear. American ingenuity allowed methane, aka natural gas, to be liberated from shale rock deposits at prolific rates and at low costs. And then cumulatively, when you add up all the benefits across that virtuous value chain, they don't total in the billions of dollars, they total in the trillions of dollars. Why? Because of capitalism and efficient market theory. And you see these types of benefits, I talked a little bit about how you see them locally in Appalachia, in places where the manufacturing of the energy actually occurs. And a lot of times that's going to be in rural and underserved communities. You got landowners who have enjoyed a windfall from gas rights leasing, and then they've reinvested those proceeds into family farms to save them, homes, kids' education, their local businesses. You've seen communities ravaged economically. They're now seeing improved employment and jobs that actually pay family-sustaining wages, which is great. So where no hope existed, attention is now turned to a future with promise. You also, not just locally, but now you step back, you start to see the benefits regionally. I used Pennsylvania as an example. It retooled its power grid to feed off of domestic natural gas, and the state's carbon dioxide intensity declined nearly 40% in just a dozen years, while its manufacturing sector was revived and businesses and homes are now enjoying lower energy bills. So whether you're for economy or whether you're for improving the situation with regard to climate or both, the natural gas industry in Pennsylvania checked all those boxes. And if you use the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection emissions data and EPA's own values for emission reductions, which they post, you put those two things together, the increased use of natural gas and power generation in Pennsylvania delivered up to $1 trillion dollars in public health benefits for Pennsylvania residents. Again, many ways, the greatest story never told. You don't hear enough of that, if any of it. And then you got these old line industries that are resurrected across the Rust Belt by the jolt of cheap and reliable energy, which means, by the way, that our friends in the building trades, they are booked solid with work. Then we stepped out even further to a higher level and talked about how America's domestic energy industry is redrawing the geopolitical map. The natural gas industry in the United States and the oil industry in the United States broke OPEC's back. Domestic carbon manufacturing allowed the United States to withdraw from endless conflicts in faraway lands. How tired are we of those? And since we now deliver our own energy security, we're able to do so. In a lot of ways, the natural gas industry in America is the biggest strategic lever against the growing threat of the ominous Chinese communist state. We've talked about that a lot on the Far Middle in prior episodes, and the Chinese Communist Party's global ambitions, as well as Russia and Putin. So there's a lot of basic underlying reasons why this miracle, and it is a miracle, occurred in a very short period of time. How did it happen so quickly? 10 years, a dozen years or so. Well, first, the free market was able to function without major government intervention. Basically, the industry innovated so quickly, it moved faster than the bureaucrats and the left were able to keep up to meddle. And then secondly, the free market allocated capital across the value chain, and what were once fragmented pieces, they quickly became enmeshed and integrated and efficient. And if the industry, the domestic energy industry, is left unmolested by the left, it's just getting started. And there are some massive opportunities on the horizon. One that got a lot of attention with the audience was that another round of disruptive and innovative technology is coming to bear. And a lot of that's being developed and demonstrated in Appalachia and by companies like mine, CNX Resources, that's going to allow natural gas manufactured at the wellhead to be efficiently transformed from gaseous methane into compressed natural gas, or CNG, and liquefied natural gas, or LNG. Those things are going to be game changers because CNG and LNG that are manufactured locally at the wellhead, they will instantly be able to displace massive volumes of foreign-sourced oil used in the transportation sector. So when you start to utilize wellhead-produced CNG or LNG into a truck or heavy equipment or a bus or an airplane in place of gasoline or diesel, a few really good things happen. Costs go down because the natural gas-derived BTUs, they're less than half the cost of gasoline or diesel BTUs. That results in huge savings that add up, as I said, not in the billions of dollars, but the trillions of dollars. Supply chains, right? How much focus is there on supply chains these days? They shrink drastically from what would be now tens of thousands of miles cumulatively with oil down to as short as dozens of miles under this type of a development chain. There are other massive benefits to this dynamic. Global CO2 and local emissions, both of those things plummet. So local emissions as well as the global emissions improve because you're now using the lowest methane intensive natural gas on the planet, which is in places like the Appalachian Basin, to displace higher emission pieces of the energy portfolio. Employment, tax base, they both go up. And again, workers in this industry, they earn family sustaining wages and they're going to pay taxes. Trade balance improves, trade deficits shrink, right? Because we're importing less energy, potentially exporting energy. As I said, the geopolitical benefits are enormous. We create not just improved energy security for ourselves, but also for our allies. Yeah, you allow doers to do their thing in domestic energy, you've got massive benefits on the scale of trillions of dollars when you think it through, and you don't have to think about it that long. But you know what? You know, the doers in domestic energy and in places like Appalachia, they're not being left alone by the left. Quite the contrary. It's as if the success of the domestic energy industry has upset the left to the point where you see the zealotry to destroy and appropriate the value of doers across the energy, domestic energy landscape ramp up. Now, Code Red for Humanity, climate alarmism, they serve as sort of the overarching religions to destroy not just the domestic energy industry, but everything tied to it. And that's my message to the Californians in the audience. That is effectively the entire private sector economy and the freedom of the individual all the way and through to California. And there are basically three tactical prongs to the left's attack under the ideology of climate alarmism to get at the domestic energy industry. The first prong of the attack is heightened regulatory standards on domestic energy production and reducing the access to be able to manufacture natural gas. You see this attack every time an administrative state bureaucrat issues a new regulation on the industry, and often they do so without the specific backing of a statute, I might add, which is unconstitutional. The second prong of the attack really goes after the domestic energy industry's access to capital, basically looking to cut off supply of what's the vital lubricant for any capitalistic endeavor. And you see this type of an attack be evident when you see major banks bow to pressure from environmental groups to basically stop lending to the carbon economy. And read, by the way, carbon economy is the same thing as the real economy, since if there's no carbon, there's no economy. That was a point that I think a lot of Californians are starting to wake up to. And then the third and final prong of the attack, I think it's the most insidious of all. It's basically shutting off future demand growth for natural gas. You see that by throwing up all kinds of roadblocks into new pipeline projects, that would convey natural gas from the producing basins to the demand centers that are growing, backdoor regulatory attacks on things like gas stove bans, gas lawnmowers, the internal combustion engine cars, of course, with EV mandates. That's a huge one. Again, the overarching objective there is to replace energy abundance with energy scarcity and to replace individual choice with what? With state control. Not good things. Now, if those are the three prongs of attack that the left uses to go after the domestic energy industry, how do they justify it? So we talked a little bit about a few convenient energy myths that the left uses and that you see and hear and are fed everywhere across California. So the first myth is that wind and solar and electric vehicles, for that matter, are zero carbon. That, of course, is nonsense. They've got massive carbon and CO2 footprints on a life cycle basis, certainly higher than natural gas power generation for sure. So that's a key underlying myth, and we dove into that into a little more detail. The second myth is that, yeah, we can manufacture wind turbines and solar panels and EV batteries at scale here in the United States. We can make them here. Well, we can't because the stuff you need to make those things, it sits largely in places like Africa and South America and China, and all the processing capacity to purify that stuff is controlled by China. So China dominates the markets for all those materials that are inputs to making the turbines and panels and batteries. So a mad dash to those things is necessarily going to create energy dependency on China by design. And by the way, that supply chain of wind turbines and solar panels and batteries, it brings with it epic human rights abuses. We talked a little bit about that and went into some detail about the ugliness of the supply chain human rights abuses tied to many of those components. And then the third and final myth that's out there to sort of justify the three-pronged attack is that you can electrify everything with these mandates, and that's going to spike demand for power, of course. And then you can force a reliance on the unreliable, intermittent solar and wind on the grid. And at the grid, when you do these things, it's going to function just fine. Well, you know what? It won't. And increasingly, it isn't. So DOE, Department of Energy itself, says that wind is only reliable 33% of the year, while solar is dependable for just 25% of the time. So why? Because, you know, the wind doesn't always blow when we need it to, and every day isn't sunny, and night sure, certainly isn't sunny either. Yeah, the consequences of these energy myths in the energy space from the left, they are real and tangible. It creates energy scarcity, that creates energy inflation, which then stokes general inflation, and it helps create energy insecurity in the West and the dependency on places like Russia and Iran, because when wind and solar inevitably fail to perform, the energy needs to come from somewhere. So a Putin feels emboldened, decides he can take a nation or two because of his energy stranglehold over the EU that the left gifted him. Iran feels emboldened because we need its oil, and it sees us pleading with EU nations to not censure Iran for violating rules in pursuing nuclear ambitions. The left's climate alarmism and its policies that go with it, they suppress individual freedoms. We talked a lot about California, the state was considering the starting of testing of car tracking. Now, the official reason was because EVs don't pay gas taxes, so tracking will allow the state to tax EVs as heavy as gas cars, which is ironic. You subsidize EVs and then you tax the heck out of them. But the real reason, I believe, is that once driving is tracked, what can you do? Well, the state then, it's very easy for it to start assigning social climate scores to individuals and individual drivers. So climate policies, once again, proven they have nothing in the end to do with CO2 levels in the atmosphere, and they have everything to do with social engineering and control of the individual. Climate change is not the problem. It's been happening for millions of years. It's climate change policies and the myths that they embody that are the problem. President Coolidge brought up this quote. He once wrote, "Isn't it a strange thing that men have the notion that they can pass a law and suspend the operations of economic law?" So that's from President Coolidge. Today, take what he said then and apply it to today, it's worse, because elites have the notion that they can pass climate policies that defy the operations of physics and scientific law. I also pointed out toward the end of the conversation that as you sort of considered and heard the left's tactical attacks on domestic energy, and then you listened and heard more and more about the energy myths that they were proffering to justify those attacks, that built over time and it created a realization in me that changed me. I used to subscribe to what I referenced as political quietism. Keep your head down, ignore the babble, do your job, that kind of thing. But with everything that we discussed on this episode and we talked about in Los Angeles, it loomed larger and larger. I began to ponder if that is what good leaders do. Is it ethical to not speak in defense of the accurate and of the rational? So I began to focus on policy advocacy. And here we are today, 160 plus episodes into the far middle. And I encourage the audience out in Los Angeles to do the same, as I encourage you constant listeners as well. And we spent a lot of time out there beyond energy policy talking about some macro issues that are affecting sort of national policy, national economy, life, and that are also areas of hyper-focus within California itself. I referenced them as hard truths. And I think you'll find that conversation interesting. We're going to save that for next week's episode of The Far Middle, so a little far foreshadowing there. But let's wrap up this episode by making a connection back to Dodgers Stadium, 2 miles to the north of where I gave that speech. Because it wasn't just a host venue for many a live concert, including those famous twin shows by Elton John, but it also was a location for the filming of one of the most famous videos in rock history. And it was an eccentric song, bordering on a weird song, by an iconic California rock group that was originally an English blues group. And it featured not just the band members as the stars of the video, but perhaps the biggest star of the video was an entire marching band from a university 9 miles to the south of Dodger Stadium. Now, can any of you constant listeners guess what or who I'm speaking of? Well, if you selected Fleetwood Mac and the single Tusk, correctamundo. Tusk was the title track of the Fleetwood Mac album that came out after their epic mega hit album, Rumors. The band hired over 100 members of the University of Southern California's marching band, known as the Spirit of Troy, and nicknamed the greatest marching band in the history of the universe, to bolster the song. And they made a video of it in the summer of 1979, a few years before the advent of MTV. So very forward thinking by Fleetwood Mac. Stevie Nicks remembers that day in Dodger Stadium. She recounts, "We recorded in Dodger Stadium one very strange Sunday afternoon when there was nobody else there. It was one of the big five experiences of my life. Seeing these kids play this song in full regalia with the gold-lined boots and the red and the Trojan helmets and screaming and yelling and playing trumpets, and I mean marching into this empty stadium, was very Twilight Zone." Yeah, the official video for Tusk captures it all. You've got the USC Trojan band, of course, Stevie Nicks acting out as a cheerleader twirling a baton, Christine McVie sort of wandering around with a glass of wine in her hand, and all kinds of other things going on. Check the video out, one of the more iconic videos for one of the oddest but best songs from Fleetwood Mac, before even MTV. Pure magic. Enjoy the week and stay connected to that far middle.